Kære lytter, jeg hedder Jørgen Steen Nielsen, og jeg skal fortælle jer, at vi nu sender en spændende forelæsning med Kate Raworth, som var i København i november, for at tale om The Donut Economy. Kate Raworth er en engelsk økonom, tilknyttet både Oxford og Cambridge University, og er den, der har skrevet bogen Donut Economics, som nu også er ude på dansk, og som er solgt på 15 sprog allerede, og som altså er en ny måde at beskrive den økonomi, vi skal bevæge os mod, hvis vi skal have bæredygtighed i bred forstand, både social og miljømæssig bæredygtighed. Det, I kommer til at høre, det er hendes forelæsning på universitetet, og efterfulgt så er der en lille samtale, hvor jeg taler med Kate Raworth om, hvordan man skal bruge de her billeder, som hun er så god til at beskrive, af en økonomi, som er bæredygtig. Så først forelæsning, og så efterfulgt af en kort samtale. God fornøjelse.
Hello. It's a lovely, amazing to be here. Thank you so much. I just want to start with a few thank yous. Thank you to Catherine and the University of Copenhagen for inviting me back here into this incredible room. Thank you to, let me try, Informationsforlag for publishing this beautiful yellow, look, lovely, fancy yellow inside leaf. It's beautiful, beautiful version of the donut in Danish. I love it. And I'd like to thank the KR Foundation for supporting me, supporting my travels here, but also the morale of support that they've been given me and the networks and the contacts they've been introducing me to, because it's who you get to talk to, of course, and the places where you get to have this conversation that really make a difference. So thank you. Let me start with the warning, the health warning. Obviously, I've turned up here and I'm talking about donuts. So let's just start with the obvious, okay? I don't mean these things. Please don't eat too many donuts. They're not good for us. The only one that's good for us is the one I'm going to introduce you to today, and it's conceptual. And on that point, thank you for being willing and so talented to have this conversation in English. You couldn't go to England and have a conversation in any other language, so I really appreciate your talents linguistically. It means we can talk. So, let me jump in. When I came here a year ago, at Catherine's invitation, the talk I gave was very much about what is wrong with 20th century economics and why it should no longer be taught. And I just want to sweep that away. I'm not going there again, because it's so last century. So today, I'm going to start right in the 21st century. And I want to start as if we were thinking about economics, which, by the way, means household management. Economics means the art of managing the household. There could be no finer calling. And I want to start economics today with a question that I was never even asked in all of my studies, which is, what is the purpose of the economy? What is it for? We never even asked that. The economy took on an implicit purpose. It was to pursue growth, this ever-rising line. And when I talk to students today and I mention this, I see this look on their face. They suddenly realize they too have never stopped to ask, what is the economy for? To what end are we managing this household in the interests of all its inhabitants? So this is where I want to kick off straight away and offer you a donut. This, to me, is one way of describing in images what the economy is for. I offer it as a compass for 21st century prosperity. So let me talk you through it. Imagine humanity's use of Earth's resources radiating out from the center of that picture. So in that hole in the middle, that's a place where people are left falling short on the essentials of life. It's where people don't have the food, healthcare, education, housing, gender equality, political voice, access to energy, and all those dimensions that every person has a claim to lead a life of dignity and opportunity and community. Now, I crowdsourced these 12 social dimensions from the world's governments. They come from the Sustainable Development Goals. So every government in the world has already agreed that every person in the world has a claim to meeting these needs. We want to get everybody in the world over that social foundation into the green ring of the donut itself. And if I were to stop there, I would be telling you the 20th century story of human rights, which began in the 1940s, an incredibly powerful and important story that is still a struggle today. But now we know more. Now I have to add on something else. Yes, we want to get everybody out of the hole and into the green ring, but we cannot use Earth's resources so much that we overshoot that outer boundary, that ecological ceiling, because there we begin to put so much pressure on this unique, delicately balanced living planet that we begin to kick it out of balance. We cause climate breakdown. We acidify the oceans. We create a hole in the ozone layer, air pollution, chemical pollution, critical biodiversity loss. And these around the outside are known as the 9 planetary boundaries drawn up by Earth system scientists, including Catherine, almost a decade ago. They came together and they said, what is it that is keeping Earth in this extraordinary, stable, benevolent state for humanity, the state she's been in for the last 11,000 years? And they said, we think it's these 9 critical life-supporting systems. We must make sure we don't put too much pressure on any one of those, because then we kick Earth out of balance into a far more hostile state. So put those 2 things together. We need to meet the needs of all people within the means of the planet. And to me, that is the purpose of the economy, from local to global, in the 21st century. And when I first drew this picture, I was really struck by the shape that it took. And I know that many people responded to its shape, these 2 circles. And it made me think very hard about the way we draw the shape of progress. Because the 20th century, the shape of progress was clear. It was GDP ever rising, up, 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 never ending. This is very different. This feels like a dynamic balance. And when I realized that, I looked back at the shapes that many ancient cultures have drawn of what well-being looks like. And I was so struck to see the connection. The Maori Takarangi, the Zen Buddhist circle, the Taoist yin-yang, the Buddhist endless knot, the Celtic double spiral, they all have a deep resonant echo of this dynamic balance. Health lies in balance. And I think health is going to be the metaphor that we know is progress and well-being this century. Not ever-rising growth, but health. So if I offer this to you as a compass, well, then you want to know where the needles are pointing. And that's not an easy picture to look at, because all of the red in this picture shows you either the extent to which people in the middle are falling short on the essentials of life, or we are overshooting planetary boundaries. Let me take this one here. Food, right? That little red wedge goes 11% of the way to the middle of the circle, because 11% of people worldwide don't have enough food to eat every day. Here we are. On water, 9% of people don't have access to clean water. 1 person in 3 worldwide doesn't have access to what we would call a toilet. But you can see on every one of those social dimensions, there are people, millions or billions, falling short. They live in countries rich and poor, mostly poor, but we know that there is a global south in the global north. So there is massive human deprivation that is still not being met. And yet, we've already overshot at least 4 of these planetary boundaries on climate change, on biodiversity loss, the breakdown of living systems, excessive fertilizer use, converting too much of Earth's land for human use. We don't even know where we are globally on air pollution and on chemical pollution. So I offer this as a snapshot of the state of humanity in our planetary home in these early days of the 21st century. Now that we see this, we can't pretend we didn't see it. You can't turn back from recognizing this moment. And I want to just turn here to Leif, an 11-year-old girl sitting here in the audience. Leif, would you stand up? Right? Leif is 11. Now, I'm almost 48. So how will the world be when Leif is 48, or when she is, stay up. We need you, right? I want you to look at Leif, because she's looking at us. She's the future. And maybe she'll go to this university. Maybe she'll teach at this university. And when she's 48, when she's 50, What will the stories that her generation tell about us? How will they describe what we did at this moment when we already knew? Stay there. We need this moral compass. So I show you this picture, and it's just some red wedges. Let me make it very, very real, right? We've all seen the news in recent days. The IPCC tell us we have 12 years to stop catastrophic effects of climate change. This was just a month ago. And then just a few weeks ago, I'm sure you saw the WWF said humans have wiped out 60% of other animals since 1970. By the way, that's the year I was born. So in this lifetime, we have got rid of 60% of other vertebrates on this planet. So we've all seen these in recent days. Perhaps you've read that microplastics are now found inside the bodies of human beings all over the world. But this news is coming up everywhere. Air pollution is a global health crisis. Land degradation threatens human well-being everywhere. Water shortages by 2050 are a serious threat in many, many countries. Phosphorus pollution is exceeding dangerous levels worldwide. Ocean acidification has hit levels not seen in 14 million years. And as for that hole in the middle, this statistic is so extreme, I can't begin to actually comprehend it. But the richest 1% of people in the world own half of the wealth in the world. These are the facts and statistics that Leif's generation will reel off about us. And then they'll say, so what did they do next? And not to leave you with despair, because it's easy to feel despair in front of this, let me add the one piece of good news. NASA says the hole in Earth's ozone layer is finally closing up because humans did something about it. So what are we going to do about the rest? Okay, take one last look at Leif, because she is taking one good look at us. Thank you. A round of applause for Leif. So what are we going to do to turn all of this story around? Well, I've shown you a global donut. And of course, what's in everybody's mind is, yeah, but what's my country doing? Where's my country? Are we the good ones? Who's the bad? So researchers at the University of Leeds took this global donut concept and they scaled it down for 150 national donuts. So here we have three very different nations. So the way this picture works is you want to fill the middle in blue. When you fill the center circle in blue, you're doing well socially. Let me remind you, this is a global scale, so it's a pretty low global bar. But to fill the middle of the circle in, you're doing pretty well globally. However, you obviously don't want to overshoot that green biophysical boundary. So over here, we've got Zambia, hardly overshooting those biophysical boundaries on one, but falling very, very far short of meeting their citizens' needs. In the middle, we've got China, which echoes the global story, falling short on people's needs and already overshooting planetary boundaries. And then today, we have Denmark signifying all of the high-income countries. Don't worry, you're not alone in this. This could be Canada, the UK, Australia, any European country you care to name, the US. In fact, you're doing better than most countries on filling that blue circle in. But oh boy, look at that overshoot on nearly every one of these planetary boundaries. By the way, this is measured not on a production impact, so not what are the production emissions and water use and materials and minerals used in this land, but consumption basis of all the laptops and lights and technologies that have come from all over the world, the global consumption impact. So these three countries are all out of balance. And that's why I say we are all developing countries now, because I've never been to a country that's developed. Let's take a look at globally across those 150 countries. So to be, if you wanted to say you're a developed country, you'd be in that top left-hand corner where the donut is. That would be a nation that met the needs of all of its people, all the social dimensions met, without overshooting the planetary boundaries. But look, there's no one anywhere near even close. Yes, Vietnam looks like it's the closest, but the real question is Vietnam moving towards that corner, or actually are they just shooting straight past it? And let me show you, where's Denmark? Oops. Denmark. Oh, you're there. You see yourselves? Where's my light pointer? Up there in that top corner, near the Netherlands, near Germany. Congratulations, you're at the top of the social list, but also pretty far over in this far corner. And this, of course, this curve, this is the path of development. It shouldn't be surprising that no country is up in that sweet spot because no country has ever even tried to get there. That wasn't what development was the last century. This is a new project. So we need new economics and we need new business models and we need new government policies to get us into that place. I love it when I find out how people are picking up this concept around the world and putting it to use. In Stockholm, a group of urban designers sent me this picture on Twitter. They said, we are designing a new suburb of Stockholm, this area here beneath the motorway. There's a station that's never been opened, and we are designing one of the world, there's a station. We're going to design a new suburb here of Stockholm. We've got your donut on our design table. We're asking ourselves, what would it mean to design one of the world's most sustainable urban living districts that meets the needs of all its people within the means of the planet? We've been having great conversations about what that could mean. I was delighted when I found out that when the government of China were launching their renewable energy strategy in 2017, explaining to the Chinese public and the world how they were going to shift from fossil fuels to clean energy, the second slide that was shown in the presentation was this, next to a quote from President Xi saying, man must learn to live in harmony with nature and in harmony with society. So it's clearly useful for people from the very local to the global scale for reframing what we think well-being looks like. But today I want to come in and zoom in and talk about the world of business. Not because I think that you're all in business, but because we're surrounded by the world of business. Everything that we're wearing, the laptops we use, the phone in your pocket, the camera in your hand, the lights in the ceiling, everything. Companies are so dominant. It's such a predominant institution in our economies. How is the world of business responding to this challenge and opportunity? So these brands, some of which you may know, have told me or worked with me in using the donut in their own corporate strategies. They've sat around a table like that and asked themselves, how does the way we do business affect humanity's ability to meet the needs of all within the means of the planet? Are we actually helping to meet everybody's human rights and coming back within planetary boundaries? Or, let's be honest, the way we're making profits is actually undermining people's human rights in some places and pushing humanity over those planetary boundaries, because that's basically the way that 20th century business worked. And what would it mean to turn that story around? So I've had conversations with hundreds of companies over the last 5 years, and I've been fascinated at how they respond when they first see this image of the donut and the challenge. And I'm going to present it to you. It's what I call the corporate to-do list. What is a company going to do when it's seen this picture from which there's no turning back? And there are five steps on this list that I find companies in. The first step is the oldest. Do nothing. Oh, it's a sorry story. But you know, the business of business is business. And everything we're doing is nearly legal. So we're just going to keep going until the cost of being fined exceeds our profits. There's no room for this. There's no room for this in the 21st century. So let's move up a step. We'll do what pays. If we will actually save money in our supply chains by cutting carbon emissions, we'll cut our carbon emissions. If we'll get a niche green consumer brand by getting that certification, we'll get that niche brand. It's incremental. Yes, it's moving in the right direction, but it's never going to get us where we need to go anywhere nearly fast enough. So to the next level, we'll do our fair share. We've heard companies say, well, our country says we're going to cut our emissions by 20% over the next 20 years, so we'll cut our emissions by 20%. We'll do our fair share. The trouble with doing your fair share, as anybody knows who's been to a restaurant with friends and everyone chips in their fair share of the bill, you don't want to be the one left holding the tray when the waiter comes, because it almost never adds up. And this is what we've seen at the global climate negotiations. We'll do our fair share when you do your fair share, but you're not doing your fair share, and we'll do it when you do. It doesn't get there. Some companies that have taken the idea of doing your fair share very seriously and have actually responded to science-based targets realize that what it means is having zero emissions. And so they go to the next stage up. We will have net zero emissions in our supply chains by 2020, by 2030, by 2045, however ambitious they set that. This has never been done before. This is ambitious. And this is responding to the actual needs in the world. But as the designer Bill McDonough would say, why be 100% less bad? We're going to do zero bad. Why not break through the ceiling of your imagination and actually do good? Could you be a company that sequestered carbon, that cleaned the water, that filtered the air, that paid living wages, that actually enriched and enabled communities? Can you be net positive? Can you be generous? Can you do the donut? I meet some companies that say, when they see the donut, they say, but that's our company logo. This is who we are. We went into business precisely to do this. And I'm fascinated that this spectrum exists. So what does it mean when we get to the top and we do the donut? What would it look like? I think there are two design principles that are going to be at the heart of the 21st century economy, whether it's in government policy, whether it's in urban design, whether it's in business. I think these are overriding principles that are going to shape where we go. And they are to create economies that are distributive by design and regenerative by design. We saw that headline, 1% of the world own half of the world's wealth. We live in extraordinarily concentrated times. And we need economies that are far more distributive of wealth and opportunity. And we can see from that excess overshoot, we have a degenerative economy. We need to turn it around and make it regenerative. Let me tell you a bit about each of these. So the 20th century was largely shaped by technologies and institutions that were centralized by design. That was the technology they had or created. And this century, we have an unprecedented opportunity because for the first time in human history, some of the most important technologies that we need and use are asking to be distributive by design. In the 20th century, energy was produced from an oil rig or a coal mine or a gas pipeline. Lots of money comes into one place to make that big investment. Communications ran through a switchboard, literally. Somebody would answer it and plug you into the other side. And ideas since the 1500s have been controlled by patents and copyrights, controlling that ownership. These are centralizing technologies. This century, we've got solar panels in villages in India, on the roof, I hope, of this university and many houses in this country, wind turbines, a distributive energy network for the first time in human history. We've got a distributed network of communication. You've all got a node of the communication in your pocket or your hand. And this lady in a village in Tanzania has one too. That is totally unprecedented. And instead of the centralizing effect of patents and copyrights, we've got the Creative Commons licensing. We've got open source design. This is an amazing, amazing technological possibility to have on the team. Distributed energy, distributed knowledge, distributed communications. We have to make this opportunity work to meet the needs of all within the means of the planet. Here's some ways that some companies have chosen in their very design to be distributive of the wealth that they create. Employee ownership. Waitrose is a very high-end supermarket in the UK. They don't have employees. They have 17,000 partners, all of whom get a profit share when the company makes money. They're holding up a sign saying 17% and everyone's cheering because they all get 17% of that. They're all in it. Chinese phone company Huawei is employee-owned, also a profit-sharing company. So the money's going to those who did the work, not to shareholders who never actually enter the enterprise. But the responsibility, of course, doesn't end at the list of employees, but goes down the supply chain. So paying not just a minimum wage, but a living wage throughout global supply chains and committing to ethical purchasing practices that don't push all the costs and risks of doing business down the chain onto the most vulnerable workers at the end. Thirdly, the idea of a fair chain. We've all heard of fair trade. An Ethiopian coffee farmer, he grows his beans, he sells his beans to a company who take them to Europe, they roast them, and then we all drink our lovely lattes. And he gets a tiny fraction of the money. Moye Coffee from the Netherlands said, you know what, we want to ensure that Ethiopia captures more of the value of this coffee chain. So they have installed roasteries in Ethiopia. Let's add the value in the source country. That is about redistributing technology and wealth across the world. That is why Moye Coffee is in business, to make that happen. And then lastly here, Lush Cosmetics are one of the companies that have committed, the first multinational corporation, to saying we are taking on a fair tax mark. We commit to paying fair taxes. That means paying the right amount of tax in the right place at the right time. We know many companies actually make a lot of their profits by avoiding paying taxes in the places where they're doing business, and they avoid it for very long, and they pay it in a haven over here and a holding company over there, and they optimize their tax return and minimize their contribution to society. So these are just four ways that in the very design of business, companies can choose to say, we want to be distributive by design. This is part of who we believe we are. What about regenerative by design? How do we come back within those planetary boundaries? Well, today we have a degenerative linear economy. We take Earth's materials, we make them into things we want, we use them for a while, and we throw them away. I'm very glad to see that the cups here are plastic, but they're reusable. The number of talks you go to and there's a one-use plastic cup on the stage, I often drink from them and chuck them just to make a point. But not using things up, using things again and again. What does this look like? That's a very minimalist picture. This is what it looks like. This is what it looks like to continually take from Earth's sources, raiding minerals into the ground, deforesting forests. And this is what it looks like to dump our waste in her sinks, dumping electronic waste in the sink of the world, which is one of the world's poorest neighborhoods, dumping plastic in lakes and rivers and oceans, which find their way back into our own bodies. We have to turn this story around. So we need to bend those arrows around so that resources are never used up, they're used again and again. So that we create economies that run on sunlight. The energy that makes these resources go around needs to be renewable energy. Waste from one process is seen as food for another. Regenerative designers say there is no such thing as waste. It's just a resource in the wrong place. An economy that's modular by design and open. Let me show you what I mean. Here are two smartphones. They do the same sort of thing, but they are completely different by design. This is an iPhone. And if it breaks, you have to send it back to Apple because it's glued shut. Glued shut so you can't get in. Proprietary control. This, some of you probably already know, this is a Fairphone. And if your Fairphone breaks or you want to upgrade it or change the battery, you can go on YouTube. There's a video showing you how to open it, how to upgrade it. It's modular by design. It even says here, yours to open, yours to keep. This is a glue technology, glue it shut. This is a clip and bolt technology so that it can be modular and used again and again. This is 21st century design. Some examples of this kind of economy in practice. In the slums of Kenya, one of the places where there were no toilets, now there are, thanks to Sanergy, which set up micro toilets throughout the community so that for the first time, people can use a toilet, have privacy, soap, clean water, dignity. It brings dignity and it brings health, ends diarrhea and cholera in the community. The waste is collected every day, it's treated and it's turned back into organic fertilizer applied back to the soil. At the technical level, they're closing the loop of nutrient use. At the social level, they're creating enterprise, they're creating health. This is a generative enterprise. Open Motors is a very 21st century car company. If you were to buy a car from Open Motors, it would arrive like this, like a wardrobe from IKEA. They say if you know what you're doing, you can assemble it in less than an hour, so good luck. But the beautiful thing is, if you don't know what you're doing, you can take it to somebody who does, because this is open source by design. As you can see, it's modular. Every single part can be replaced separately. And it's open for anyone to see on the internet how that chassis is assembled. So anybody can set up around the world as an assembler, supplier, repairer, refurbisher of an Open Motors car. And once that basic chassis is assembled, then it can be customized for the different places in the world and the different uses it's being used for. Here, like an electric streetcar, 100% electric, 100% modular. I live in the city of Oxford, and at the end of my road is the BMW factory making minis. All the mini cars in the world are made there, and they're shipped off the factory line, full of air, sent around the world. It's crazy. We should be shipping parts and assembling and reassembling and reusing and refurbishing and recustomizing. This is the beginning of 21st century distributed manufacturing. And then lastly, the Swedish clothing company Houdini. All of the clothes that they make are made either from wool and tencel, which are organic fibers, so they can bring them back. They decompose them. In fact, they decompose some of them in a bin. They turned it into soil. They grew mushrooms on top, and then they served it to their customers, and they said, "You're eating your old ski wear." All the clothing is made from recycled nylon and recycled polyester, so it can be used again and again. They've separated it into these two loops. And Houdini, actually, are one of the first companies in the world to do an assessment of their own materials according to the planetary boundaries, that outside of the donut and the inside. They're serious about being a regenerative company, so they're testing themselves against higher standards than anyone else is being set. Now, this is lovely. Houdini's clothing is fantastic. It's very expensive, by the way. You may know it's very expensive. Of course it's expensive. Like it was expensive to put a solar panel on the roof of your house in 1976. But you know what? When the outlier starts to build critical mass, and when this becomes the norm, look what's happened with the price of solar panels. It's dropped. It's cheaper to install solar energy than it is in over 40 countries in the world, and that number is rising every day. And if this circular manufacturing became a standard, this would be the way all clothes were produced. Now, I want to just take the clothing example for a moment. It's a lovely idea. Let's say this top I'm wearing. Say the company that made this top were inspired, and they said, oh, we'll have a circular economy too. So, you know, let's say this was our linear supply chain, and we sold you things, and you just threw it away. Bring it back to us. Bring the top back to us, and we'll reuse it again. If I can just ask Catherine, just hold that. So let's imagine the jacket Catherine's wearing, the company who made the jacket, she's going to send it back to them. But then another clothing company get jealous and they say, well, send your jacket back to us. There we are, close the loop. Now, I want everyone to imagine whatever top, jacket, shirt, skirt you're wearing, imagine that the company that you bought this from said, send it back to us. I want you to make a little loop above your head. I really do. Yes. Right. And now we have a circular economy. You look fantastic. Bring your hands down, because of course nature would absolutely laugh at us. Nature does not turn a daffodil into a daffodil and a peacock into a peacock. Nature breaks the living blocks of life down, back to life blocks, and turns it back into an ecosystem. Nature creates an ecosystem of resources. Now this is what it would mean to have a circular economy, where the materials came back and were turned into something else, not a series of loops, every company doing its own thing. So what would it take to have an ecosystem of textile reuse and metals reuse and plastics reuse and minerals reuse? No company can do that alone. This is a crucial role for bringing the whole industry together, the sector together. The government needs to step in and say, we need an ecosystem here. This is what I wanted to say. We want to make sure we don't end up with that corporate-driven circularity, everybody their own little loop, but we get that commons-based circularity, an ecosystem approach, where resources are used again through the community in a knowledge commons. Now, what would it take to do this? Some cities, and cities, as we know, are often leading these days, where national governments fail to lead, cities step in and they lead. Some cities have started doing a circular economy scan, saying, okay, here at the level of our city, what can we do? Here in Glasgow, they've done a circular economy scan. Here they're looking at their meat, fish, and bread industries and beer, a very Glaswegian diet, and looking at the connection between all those different loops. What, how does the waste from one of those food processes become the food for the next? What else can we connect? This is not going to happen from within one company alone. And of course, think of the energy required to make those loops go around. One of my favorite facts of the year is that now over 100 cities worldwide generate more than 70% of their energy from renewable sources. Sun, wind, waves, geothermal. They are in countries rich and poor. This is popping up everywhere. And as much as we have to look at the hard, very frightening, very overwhelming facts, we also have to look at the really positive ones where things are with us and on our side. So let me pull back. I believe that if business is going to be bringing humanity into this space, it needs to be regenerative by design and it needs to be distributive by design. So why is it that some companies still would just say, that's a sorry story, but the business of business is business, And others are way at the top of that list saying, this is who we are, this is why we exist. What is it? Now we have to turn not to the design of the product, to the design of the supply chain, we have to turn to the design of the company itself. And this is what I call corporate psychotherapy. You know, when people first go to a psychotherapist, they say, oh, look, I need your help. I have relationships with all these really difficult people in my family. Don't ask about my mother, but I just want you to help me. And the more psychotherapy they do, they say, oh, it's not them. It's me. I need to change. And that, for me, is what's going on with companies. Companies like to say, we have these very difficult suppliers around the world. It's very difficult to track down what's going on in our global supply chains. No, let's start at home. Let's look inside the design of the company itself. Because I think we are in the middle of a fascinating psychological drama in the transformation of business. From a 20th century extractive enterprise model to a 21st century generative enterprise model. So think of a very 20th century business that you know of. I think these companies have been run by one underlying question. How much financial value can we extract from this enterprise? We see it in the papers. You hear it on the news. You hear it in the justifications made by the bankers, by the major companies, by the fossil fuel companies, justifying. This often drives what happens in the boardroom. But when I talk to 21st century designers, if I talk to Moya Coffee, to Houdini, to the urban designers in Stockholm, they are asking, and Open Motors, they are asking, Fairphone, they are asking such different questions. The one question that you can hear behind everything that they're saying and doing and exploring is how many benefits can we generate in the way we design this enterprise? Benefits for society, benefits for culture, benefits for the living world, financial benefits for us so we can keep opening the doors next year and next month and next decade, yes. But that's not what drives us. What drives us is the possibility of what this business can do in the world. So what explains that extraordinary gap in the deepest question that drives business? And here I turn to the work of a brilliant business analyst, Marjorie Kelly. She drew up 5 design traits. I think of them as the DNA of business, the 5 DNA points. So I invite you, think of any company you know, one that you really admire or one that you really, really wish would leave the scene. And I invite you, any company in the future that you encounter, to ask yourself these 5 design traits, and you'll understand so much of what it does and why. And the first one, as I began this talk, the first one is purpose. If we don't begin with purpose, we don't even know where we're trying to go. So what is the purpose of the company? A typical 20th century company might have had as its purpose maximizing shareholder returns, or to be the biggest player in our sector, or had the largest market share in Europe. But Moya Coffee, their purpose is to show that coffee can actually enrich and empower the communities who grow it. That's their purpose, to show that the coffee supply chain can be different. Fairphone's purpose, Fairphone began as a campaign. And then they realized the best way to campaign was to make the darn thing and show that mobile phones could be made differently. They want to make a phone that is as free as possible from environmental and social exploitation. And of course, the ultimate goal is to make it positive. What about the governance of a company? When I was speaking recently with the head of Triodos, the Dutch bank, which is openly committed to social and environmental value, as well as a fair financial return, he told me every Monday morning, the whole company spends the first 45 minutes talking about our purpose. Maybe a presentation from somebody about what we're doing. We focus on the purpose, and that sets the tone for the rest of the week. Unilever. I see Unilever governing itself very differently under the leadership of Paul Pullman. If you look at Unilever, they've set a different purpose. They have a sustainable living plan, and they've set themselves some metrics, around 60 metrics of cutting carbon emissions, cutting water use, improving health, very different metrics from those mere 20th century metrics of increased profits, increased market share, increased sales. Unilever also say to the markets, we're not going to give you quarterly reports. If you want quarterly reports, you're investing in the wrong company. This is a governance mechanism. And then networks. Who are you networking with? How do you relate to your customers? How do you relate to your suppliers? How do you relate to those you might call your competitors but are probably actually your allies for making change? Have you joined the Fair Tax Mark or the Ethical Trading Initiative? Are you part of Fair Trade? How are you networking to be something bigger than yourself? But now let's go to the really deep stuff, because as in psychotherapy, the most profound stuff lies deepest. So how are you owned? Because whether you're owned by the workers or by a family or private investors or the stock market or venture capital, who owns you is profoundly going to shape how you're financed and the quality of the finance that comes to you and what it demands and the question that it's asking. And I think it's no coincidence that some of the most progressive companies that I've come across are privately owned. They're owned by families or they're owned by entrepreneurs who have a conviction, who have something here that says we are just determined to do this differently. We don't know how. We don't know how we'll make it work, but we're going to show it can be done. They're not driven by a market that says we need faster returns tomorrow. Many of the world's companies in this psychotherapy session find themselves in a moment of corporate schizophrenia. They can transform their purpose. They can transform their governance. They can change the networks they move in. But if they are owned by the stock market, then they are pulled back by that 20th century question. And many companies that I've shown this slide to, people literally go, that's me, and can see that split. Some of the companies that I know are in this position, and I admire what they're aiming to do. DSM began called Dutch State Mines. Over time, they've morphed out of mining into pharmaceuticals. They changed their name to do something meaningful. H&M, Unilever, Marks and Spencers, these are all companies that very publicly are transforming what they're for, transforming their governance, changing their networks because they want to be part of a 21st century progressive mindset. And they know that they are partly pulled back because they're owned through the stock market, which has different priorities. And it's fascinating seeing very impressive leaders of those companies trying to figure out how to pair these together. How do we do that? And I've been having lots of thoughts about how companies in this situation can do it. If you want somebody, raise it, we can come back and talk about this later. But also, what can governments do? Because no company alone can sort this out, right? We want all those arrows turned in the one direction. No company alone can turn those arrows around. What's the role of the government to change the culture, to change the law, to change what's normal, to change the practices in industry such that ownership and finance are aligned? To me, this is the business journey of the 21st century. We have to turn these arrows towards a generative future. So let me sum up what I've said about companies. Imagine every business sitting around this table and asking itself, are we helping bring humanity into this space or driving humanity out? Where is any particular company? And if you work for a company, I really invite you to look honestly at that list and ask yourself, where's my company right now? And where are we trying to get to? Because what matters is not where you're at now, but where you're heading. And don't try to go one step at a time. We need leaps. If you want to leap to the top, what would it mean for the company to be regenerative and distributive by design? And how is the company itself designed in a way that shapes what it can be and do in the world, that leaves it asking the extractive question or allows it to ask the generative one? Now, I've told this story with companies, but if you work for a university, if you work for an NGO, if you work for a government department, you can ask yourself the very same questions. Copenhagen University, what is its purpose? How is it governed? How does it network? How is it owned? How is it financed? They will be having exactly the same kinds of implications for what the university can be and do in the world. So let me pull back to where I began. I began with this shape, because this is the shape that ruled the 20th century, the ever-rising line of growth. And I want to end on the most difficult question, because I don't want to avoid it. I have the privilege of not working for a government or a company or even being fully employed by university, and so I can ask this question. I actually feel a responsibility to ask it, because my employer doesn't prohibit me. We have economies that need to grow, whether or not they actually make us thrive. The 20th century was fixated on GDP. It became written into the institutional design of our economies. And I think it's crucial to recognize growth is a wonderful phase of life, right? And a growing economy is so much easier to work with than one that's not growing. But let's look deep into the structure of growth, because we have economies today that are actually structurally addicted and dependent upon. They expect, demand, and depend upon growth, No matter how rich they already are, I bet Denmark really, really wants its economy to grow. Imagine what India, Sri Lanka, Zambia think. They look at Denmark way at the top of the GDP table, and they hear that Denmark just wants to grow. There's something very, very strange that every country, no matter how rich it already is, believes that its solutions to its challenges lie in more growth. So how are we structurally dependent? We are financially dependent upon growth because we've created a financial system, and by the way, it's just a design. There's nothing immutable, inevitable, or unchangeable about the financial system we have, but it's designed to pursue the maximum rate of financial return. It's that extractive 20th century question. And so it puts publicly traded companies under pressure to show every month they are getting increased sales, increased profits, increased market share. We have a financial system that has been designed to create money by issuing it as debt-bearing interest. That is how money is created, and that drives growth. We have a political system that is locked into growth. The G20 will be meeting at the end of this month. No leader wants to lose their place in the family photo. But if your economy stopped growing, well, the rest keep going, well, you would be booted out by the next emerging powerhouse, by Vietnam or Nigeria or whoever's coming up behind you. So this is a really serious global geopolitical lock-in. Everybody has to keep growing, to keep up with their neighbors who are keeping growing, to keep up with them, to keep their place at the geopolitical table. This is not an economic question. This is a global international relations, geopolitical, global governance question, and it's not getting anything like the amount of attention it deserves. Governments also want growth because no government wants to raise the tax rate, but every government wants an increase in tax revenue. And a growing economy is the easiest way to bridge that gap. And lastly, we are socially hooked on growth. Thanks to a century of consumer propaganda, which is a fascinating story. A man called Edward Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he took his uncle's psychotherapy and he turned it into retail therapy. He realized if he could connect our deepest desires to be loved and admired to an object, and that if I have this phone, I am now elegant and superior and worth admiring. And he did that. And he called it propaganda and public relations. He invented the advertising industry, and he was so successful. I wish we could bring him back. I'd say, well done, Edward. Could you now join the other team? How are you going to undo 100 years of that consumer advertising? Because we actually need to stop believing that we transform ourselves every time we buy something more. So we are financially, politically, and socially locked into the idea that an economy must expect, demand, and depend upon growing forever. But just step back and look at nature. She's been thriving for 3.8 billion years, so it's a really great example to learn from if we, too, want to stick around. This is nature's growth curve. Growth is a wonderful, healthy phase of life. I have 10-year-old twins. They're about the same size as Leaf, and they're growing really fast. But if they keep growing forever, they literally won't fit at my kitchen table anymore. They won't belong. In nature, things grow, and then they grow up, and they mature. And it's only by growing up and maturing that they can move from growing to thriving. Things that survive don't grow forever. They thrive. And to me, this is the ultimate economic existential question of our century. How can we create economies that enable us to thrive, whether or not they grow? I'm not into saying, oh, GDP needs to stop now, up, down. Who knows? The changes ahead of us are so extreme. An enormous energy transition. Much of the products we use will move from ownership to service. We need to regenerate so many of the living systems that we've run down on this planet. We've got a rise in the digital global commons. We've got automation. We've got blockchain. Who on earth thinks they can tell us whether GDP is going to go up or down, then up? But at the moment, we have an economy that's locked into saying it has to keep going up. And that is stopping us from making the much bigger transitions we need to make. So to me, this is a profound question that's almost never, ever asked on any economics degree and is never mentioned in politics or business because it's just deeply uncomfortable. I'm going to stop there and say that if you want to look deeper into these ideas, I was talking about the business world particularly, I was invited to the World Economic Forum in January this year, so I saved this blog until I was sitting in the belly of the beast in Davos, and I wrote a blog about corporate psychotherapy from within Davos. If you're interested in the ideas of donut economics that I've touched on, these are one-minute animations that tell you each of the seven ways. And as you can see, they're playful and silly and irreverent and funny, because I think it's so important to take economics out of the ivory tower and make it accessible and engaging and political to everybody. And if you want to join a discussion group, you are extremely welcome to join. So let me leave you with the one donut that turns out to be good for us. And I am really profoundly looking forward to the conversation that's going to follow. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Kate. Thank you for planting all these new images in our minds. Thank you for focusing on solutions. I'm very happy that there's so much to digest that I'm very happy that we have this video coming out on the website of Copenhagen University, because it's difficult to take it all in at once. In fact, I feel like when I see the last scene of my favorite movie, Casablanca, when it's over, I think I want to see it again. And I'm even tempted to paraphrase Humphrey Bogart saying, this could be the beginning of a new beautiful relation between humanity and Earth. Now the word is Ida's. Ida Augen is going to take the difficult challenge to comment on this, give a critical comments if you have any. You have 10 minutes and then we open up for discussion.
Thank you so much, Kate, and you are just such a wonderful storyteller. I admire everything you've done, because you've actually transformed the whole world and the way they think, and I really want to thank you for that. I actually consider this book not a coffee table book, but a coffee table weapon, so that everybody who has read this book now are better at conversations over the coffee table on how to move thinking, especially economic thinking. I think your critique of the traditional neoliberal economy is spot on. I think your image up here is a very beautiful way of putting the SDGs in a way that is very easy to overlook, because 17 goals are just impossible to have in your mind at the same time, and they all, you know, they all are intertwined in so many ways. And I think where I start to get a little bit troubled as a politician and as somebody who's really concerned about change and getting things done, I go back and I read Brundtland Report. And if we read Brundtland Report from 1987, we are told that development must meet the needs of the present without compromising the ability of the future generations to meet their own needs. That is basically the donut. And not as beautifully put, not as an image. What I think you put very beautiful is, if you want to erase an image of like the GDP image, you have to put something in the place of it. It's old school framing, not only framing it with words, but also with images and concepts that can transform things. But actually, I would say the insights of this go back to Brundtland in 1987, and maybe all the way back to Stockholm Declaration 1972 and Limits to Growth. We could also take the Rio Declaration. We can no longer think of environment and economic and social development as isolated fields. And I also went to Rio in 2012, and we talked about these three pillars of sustainability actually being a DNA. How can we actually look at all three at the same time? Because I often find the solutions that think about the economic, the social, and the environmental sustainability at the same time are the best ones. So I honestly, all of this is, of course, what you're building on. Where it gets difficult for a politician is, how do we get into this donut? I mean, what is the motivation for people to move into this donut? How do I get my colleagues in the Ministry of Finance to start thinking like this? They will only do that if all of you have the conversations at your coffee tables with this book, and that you start to move this thinking. That's one way of, you know, the political movement that we can start, and that I think you're doing beautifully. But I often, if I go back and look at some of your cases, like Sanergy, why did they set up these toilets? I mean, I'm asking the question, why did that happen? I assume somebody financed it. I assume that was something in it for them. I assume that there was like some of these old school motivations for people, because we are egoistic. We are obsessed with ourselves. So I think there's what's in it for me we cannot get over with. That will be part of humanity and humankind forever. So we have to also think about how can we nudge that egoistic side of people while still talking to the larger side in us. So we have to do both. We have to, you know, look at societal changes, talk about the ethics in this, but also be clear and completely realistic about what's in the end driving things. So I'm very interested in a political economy where we get people moving into this donut. And in all the cases, I think it's very interesting to look at what was the motivation. I don't think it was an abstract model of we have to do something, because that has been around for so long. I think that something else has happened. I think it's a political movement of an understanding of a bigger pressure. But then, is it economy that's going to fix it? Is it like now we'll come up with a whole new economic area and we'll talk about things? Or is it actually what happened to me when I was a minister, which was my wake-up call? I remember this was 2012, and I was going to talk to the environmental economist in Denmark. And my ministry had given me a speech on what all the great work they're doing, but I thought, they are lagging out on all these things. Why are they not calculating? And then I just started counting all the things that they were not adding into their calculations. And then one of them just took his hand up and said, isn't that your job? That's your job as a politician to overlook all of these interests, that it's not all economy, that we should actually limit economic thinking to where it's good, to a tool. So instead of turning ethics, which I think is one of your 7 principles, into an economic concept for itself, I would rather say, you cannot, ethics is not math. You cannot calculate what is the right thing to do. You have to, like you say, turn to the purpose and make that decision an ethical decision, and then look at the economy as a tool from this point of view. So if we overstate the economic thinking, we are back where we started, I think, 45, 50 years ago. So what I'm looking for when I'm looking for change is actually exactly what you're saying, like strong, strong images instead of just the scary, I can take your curve on where the world's going with GDP, and we can look at all how CO2 is going this way, and acidification, and air pollution, and everything on this curve. And we can tell people how bad it is. And I think actually when you put the red into this, it's a beautiful overview, and every country should be measured like this, like with GDP, but it's not giving them the way out. So this is where we need new ideas on how can we transform a whole system into renewable energy. So we have to start there. How do we transform a society into 100% renewable energy? And I would say, okay, we know we need solar power, wind power, we need redistributed energy consumption, we need smart technology to actually move the consumer into this, because we cannot do it with cables, we cannot build enough cables for everyone to charge their electrical vehicle, and we know who needs to be on this page when we discuss it. But this is not only for economists. This is really a huge vision of how to transform the whole energy sector that is needed. And it's actually images like this I would take and put on the forefront. Like, how does a completely 100% renewable energy system look? Or how does a completely circular economy consumption model look? Those are the models that we need. And I would urge you to write the next book and actually show us with all the kinds of knowledge, because I think that's what you do brilliantly, going across sections, putting this, like giving us those visions instead of all the scary images that we kind of keep moving towards. And then I want to say, we should not be naive on the development at the moment, because yes, things are becoming from centralized to distributed because of technology, but if you take your 2 phones and you put Facebook on your smartphone, it doesn't matter whether it's a Fairphone or an Apple phone. You're right in the old area. We've not seen monopolies coming out like we're seeing it right now with technology. Facebook, Apple, Google, Amazon. And we can talk about fair chains, but that doesn't matter. Amazon is actually going to wipe out all chains in the retail. They're actually going to go in and try and take out all retail and just create their chain. So we can talk all we want about fair chains, but when we have Amazon coming in with their ways of thinking chain, it's definitely not distributed. We have in China, we have Baidu, Tencent, and Alibaba doing the exact same thing. So we might tell beautiful stories about what's happening, but we have to keep eyes that there's a new problem coming in with 100 miles an hour at this model. And that, I think, is one of the things we really have to look at right now. So for many of the images that you have, I think there are very many political problems, and I am not sure I know now how to get into the donut. I would love to get there, and I would love all of you to tell me to get there, because political will, people like, why is there no political will? I think there's so much political will, but if you're a leader and nobody's following you, you're just a guy taking a walk, you know? So we need to create that followership of political leadership, and that's not only economic thinking, that's ethics. That is looking at leaf and saying, like you do, we have to move now whether or not this is economically the best thing to do from a short-termism. So I think I love your book. I think it's actually very political. I think you're putting so many people on the same page. You're giving us a beautiful coffee table weapon. And I think the important thing is actually all of the people that you also think that you've mobilized in this room that will go out and tell some of the same stories. From the political perspective, we have not yet found all the way there. I think we do have ideas on how to get to 100% renewables. We do have ideas on how to get to a more circular setup. We're trying to set it up in Denmark with plastics, 5 types of plastics, for instance. How can we close the loops and the circles and design differently? But we need to think about economy not has actually been too much part of the picture, and we need to maybe narrow it down to say, what can it do, what can it not do? And I think that would be probably from a political standpoint the biggest critique. And the last thing I would say is the 2 design principles. I absolutely agree with you. Distributive by design, regenerative by design. Distributive by design, Denmark is actually, like you've seen, we are distributive by design. The problem is, it's not enough to redistribute money. That's what we're finding out in Denmark. I'm sure you know Jim Heckman. We have 10% of the population that no matter how much money you will distribute, will never be able to have the opportunities because they need social skills, they need networking skills, they need language skills. It's not enough to give them money. So that's one example of why redistributive is not enough, because you have to redistribute much more than money. And secondly, regenerative by design, is, I think, the whole circular economy and all of the work of Bill McDonough and Michael Braungart and Ellen MacArthur Foundation is giving us some really good examples, but they have to be very concrete, and it's the concrete cases that are moving. And we do not yet have a donut case. So we have to break it down, and that's my last point. When coders see a big problem, they know that it's just a lot of small problems. I love that image, that if you see a big problem, think about it, it's just a lot of small problems. And this is turning everything into a big problem. And I would love to break it down into small problems again, because we cannot do all of this at the same time. It's when it becomes concrete. It's in the concrete decisions. It's when you go out and discuss with your companies, your organizations, your political leaders, when you go vote. This is where we go into the donut, or at least go into a more sustainable economy. So that's my point.
Thank you so much, Ida. I don't know, would you like a short response to that?
Oh, yes. So, thank you. And I just want to say, I don't want this to be weird, because I've, where was I? In the Netherlands, I was invited in a context a bit like this to debate with an economist who was rabidly against me. And I know that actually, standing in the full political spectrum, we're probably right next to each other. So, with all that said, right, and I really like the way you're just openly critiquing what I'm doing, so let me openly come back.
I thought I was being very discreet, but that's a typical Danish mistake.
yes, Brundtland. It's been there. It's the idea of, in fact, it goes back hundreds of years. And sometimes people hear me talk and they say, well, what's new here? I've heard this before. To which my favorite response is a quote from the philosopher André Gide. He said, everything that needs to be said has already been said, but since nobody was listening, it has to be said again. And I think that's what... That's what Brundtland and the Limits to Growth and Tim Jackson and Donut Economic, we're just bringing this story back again and again because it's not yet become the reality. So I've drawn it in pictures with donuts. We need to keep presenting it. But there is a very big difference, I think, with Brundtland and this framing. Yes, so and you read the quote, meet the needs of the present without compromising the needs of future generations. When we now look at the donut, we could say, oh, well, that's what that is. But in those times, again, the economic thinking that actually is deeply embedded with ethics and values, and we need to make them explicit, the economic thinking was growth will be endless, therefore future generations will be richer than us, they'll have more technologies, they'll have more money. This was literally the economics I was taught, the logic. Therefore, it would be inappropriate, would be not maximizing utility if we do too much today for them, because they're going to be richer than us. And actually, this is partly what Bill Nordhaus, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics, his model had this kind of assumption written into it. The future will be richer, so we shouldn't sacrifice too much because they're going to be able to cope with what comes at them. This is very distinctly different. This says humanity today and in the future depends on critical life-supporting services. They are breaking down. As Catherine once said, there are limits to pressure that we can put on the planet. How is humanity going to respond to that? We can't trade that off at a discount rate into the future. So I think this is actually very different from the context of Brundtland in the late 1980s. I will resist the temptation to respond to everything. But I'll just pick up on a few. So you said, we have to admit it, we're egoistic. David Hume, the philosopher, said, there lies in each of us something of the serpent and something of the dove. So whenever you say we're egoistic, I would just ask you to say we are also deeply social. We are both of these things. Because we're the most social of all mammals. If we look across the entire mammal kingdom, we are more social than the naked mole rat. Especially when it comes to interacting with those beyond your immediate family. No other species cooperates in the way that we cooperate. We want the what's in it for me, but very often what's in it for me is not money. It's recognition. It's feeling valued. It's feeling like I've contributed. That's why people volunteer. That's why people create open source code. That's why people show up and put on events, because they want to feel like they were bigger than part of something bigger than themselves. So how do we tap into that? I think too much 20th century economics told us we're a rational economic man. He's self-interested. He wants money. And therefore too many policies were framed around that incentive. Nurses and teachers get very offended when they're told, we'll give you performance-related pay. They say, do you really think that's why I dedicate my life to teaching these children or making these people better because I'm trying to earn more money? You offend me with your assumptions about my motivations. So we need to reward people for the true reasons why they engage in things. Thirdly, I can see you. I'm nearly done. So part of your critique is that I'm trying to make economics too big. And yes, in my book, I talk about 7 ways to think like a 21st century economist, and it seems to cover everything. By the way, economics, the language of economics, has claimed the stage. It is the language in which public policy is conducted. And when people are analyzing things, when the economist comes in the room, somebody important has arrived. So it's already claimed that space. But what I aim to do is invite the economist into the room with humility. So this diagram is the first diagram in my book. It is not written in any economic language at all. It's written in the language of human well-being. Do you have enough food, healthcare, education, housing? Do you have political voice? Do you have gender equality? This is the language of social science and social care. And let us speak of our planet, who, by the way, is missing completely from mainstream economics. How is the planet's atmosphere? What's the state of her soils, her waters, the ozone layer? Now we've established these fundamentals of human planetary well-being. Now we invite the economist into the room. And now you, economist, must explain why your economic thinking and your principles are in any way fit for taking on this challenge. So actually, I think it profoundly shrinks the economist's role and rewrites progress, not in the language of GDP, and we just have to account for everything in GDP. It says 21st century well-being will be accounted for in human and natural metrics, and economists need to learn to read those too. My very last point. Internet 2.0, yes. And because of time, I didn't cover everything. I absolutely know that when I say we have these distributive technologies, this is an unprecedented opportunity. Your mind and many people's mind goes Facebook, Uber, Google, hello. I think internet, and anyone who knows internet 1.0 was this incredible, by the way, freely created public good by people who were not motivated by money but were creating something that they saw could exist. It was a space of, they said, there'll be no trade here. It will be open ideas and sharing. It was utopian, Internet 1.0. Internet 2.0, some big, very egoistic people came along and said, aha, network effects of distributed scale. Let me capture Facebook. Let me capture these. This is not the end of the story. I believe there is absolute possibility emerging of Internet 3.0. I'm going to give you one example. Internet 2.0, so the digital platform that we all have in our pockets means that companies can create a platform-based market. And Uber used that technology, put it together with very mainstream venture capital, and you get Uber. You get a brilliant digital platform that exploits the workers who work for it, and they rise up and rebel against it. In Austin, Texas, they said, actually, Uber, you have to fulfill all sorts of regulations to work here. And Uber walked off and said, well, we won't work here. The very same technology was picked up, turned into a platform owned by local taxi drivers. So same technology, different values, different purpose, different governance, different networks, different ownership, different finance. They now have something called Ride Austin, which is owned by the local drivers. You can make a contribution to a local charity. It has completely different ethos. So the technology is the same. The purpose and the effects are totally different. So I wouldn't say Amazon is going to drive out supply chains. That's like saying it's inevitable. This is a design choice. This is a regulatory choice that governments need to make together. We can design this differently, and I'm determined to see an Internet 3.0 emerge. And there I leave it, and I'm so delighted to be having this conversation.
Yeah. Ida has been taking a lot of notes.
Yeah.
Now you have to choose because you have 1 minute to respond.
I would love if you could really teach economists humility. That would be beautiful, but then it's not donut economy, then it's donut. And then ethics should be, you should invite the ethicist, and behavioral science and how to mobilize people, you should invite the and say it's not all economy. It's actually, we do a lot of things, we have to put other things in the forefront. So I think that would be, and then the second thing is, the rational person is the one where you believe that if you keep saying the same thing with new images, the rational person will do the right thing. No, they won't. No, they won't. You can say it as many times as you want. You know, we want to do the same thing. I nodded through every side of your. You're absolutely right. We're 100% on the same page. But if we want to get people moving, we have to understand they're not rational 80% of the time. So we really have to think about how we move people into that donut. And I'm not sure the economy is the key way there. I think moral ethics, talking about leaf. And understanding also what we are up against, because you're not going to move Jeff Bezos to another purpose than being the richest person on this planet forever. We're not. So it's a huge fight, and so it's like between right and wrong, and you cannot calculate right and wrong with economy.
So the reason I wrote a book called Donut Economics is because I studied economics, and I was so frustrated by what I was taught. What change, we each can ask, what change can I make in the world? The change I can make in the world is come back to the subject I walked away from. So here's the donut. It asks many questions. I brought to it economics. Is there anybody in the room who'd like to write a book called Donut Technology? Because that would be amazing. How about a politician who could write a book called Donut Politics? Please do. How about Donut Communities? Donut Ethics?
I feel this conversation is not over, but we have a few minutes left, so I want to let in a few questions.
Hi, everyone. My name is Annette. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Ida. Kate, I'm a bit puzzled by some of the companies that you highlight as the 21st century champions. So for me as a young critical environmentalist, what these companies like Unilever, H&M and Mars do is that they share candy floss strategies where they take initiatives to mitigate their environmental footprint by recycling, or by designing for recycling, by engaging in cleanups. But none of them really touch the root causes of the problem. None of them are really ready to challenge the growth model that you talk about. So how can we really get to this fast and genuine change if these companies are the ones that we highlight as the champions?
Great question. So can I just point out that the companies I highlighted as the champions were companies like Moye Coffee, Fairphone, Lush Cosmetics, Houdini. Oh, no, but remember when I said H&M? It was on a slide which showed these are examples of shareholder-owned companies that are trying to change. And that was my slide called Corporate Schizophrenia. So like the minister, I know it's important to acknowledge attempts to change, and I'm not going to be a purist and only hold up the most pure examples. It's important to show that those who are trying to make change, I genuinely believe that Paul Pullman is trying to do something good with this extraordinary large multinational. Maybe you don't, and that's an open question. What I wanted to show there is that if you are owned by the stock market, then you can go so far, but not far enough. And that's exactly why you have a problem with it, because you understand that they're not doing enough. And I think one of the reasons they're not doing enough is because how they're owned and how they're financed. So they were my example of companies in a bind as opposed to the really truly progressive ones.
Thanks. My name is Lars Kutcher from ActionAid Denmark. And it's a follow-up on this question, because you said at one time, you say, if you're stock market owned, to some extent, the logic is you cannot move beyond what you call do what pays.
What do you call what?
You say stock
do
market
what pays.
Owned, do what pays is on your slide. Can you move beyond that? I'm asking that because the saying in Denmark and globally to meet the sustainable development goals, because the companies have stolen all our money and we have accumulated all the wealth one place, we have to look for that place to finance the sustainable development goals. But if they only will do what pays if they're stock market owned, then we have to change the ownership.
I think we take the second question at the same time.
My name is Christian Ege from an NGO, the Danish Ecological Council. Thank you for a very inspiring speech, two speeches. I would like to ask you, Kate, about what should be the incentives, what should be the drivers to bring us to this good point. Should it be the ethics of the company leaders or what? You didn't say anything about green taxes, for instance. I would like to ask, how will you get rid of the unsustainable products? How will you bring us on to the sustainable products? You mentioned H&M. They have some good projects, but I don't see them advertised with a slogan called Buy Less Clothes. How will you let them do that?
I didn't mean to say that companies that are owned by the stock market will only and can only ever do what pays. I think there are actually, I know there are some companies that are shareholder owned that have joined the Science Based Targets Initiative and said we will take on a science-based target to get to net zero carbon emissions in our supply chains. They've taken on the commitment, living it through and actually getting there and the shareholders allowing them to get there, that's unseen. As countries like my own or like Sweden have set a net zero carbon emission for the nation, now we've got to do it. It's one thing to set the target, now you've got to get there. But to me, this is the heart of the challenge that the extractive mentality of the stock market in the face of higher ambition for transformation. Yes, we need companies to be on board with the sustainable development goals, and often they give us a kind of greenwash, as you said. You know, oh, look, we have health here and clean up there. I want to set a higher standard, and I want to look at the design of the company itself and not just the nice things they do on the side. So to your question and yours, by the way, I don't know how we're going to do this, right? If I am giving the impression that I know it and I'm just not being clear enough about all the answers, what I do know, what I deeply believe is that we are influenced, yes, by tax rates and financial incentives, but actually I think we're profoundly influenced by the fundamental metaphors. So the 20th century metaphor was progress is growth. And as I said at the beginning, I think the 21st century metaphor is going to be progress, is health, is balance. We know it in our own bodies. So I draw this picture. And if somebody said to me, you can only show one image, you can stand up in front of all the world leaders, you can show one stat, one image, I would just show this, because this is a profound paradigm reframing. So I haven't talked about green taxes, and I haven't talked about regulation. To me, that is like, that flows once you get clear the vision of what you're trying to do. That flows. But let's be clear. Yes, of course we need to shift taxation from taxing companies for hiring people. That's a good thing, isn't it, these days? To instead tax them for using Earth resources and dumping into Earth's sink. It's the no-brainer of shifting from labor to resources. We need to have regulation that says you cannot stuff plastics and resources, you cannot bury them in the ground. Leaf's generation will say, what? You used to just think it was okay to bury things in the ground? What planet were you on? We need to ban single-use plastics. We need governments to have the ability and the courage to step up and say we're going to use only these taxes. And I would say, yes, there's political will, but I bet there's also a lot of corporate lobby. stopping, not maybe your party, but other parties. There's a lot of corporate power stopping this, stopping this, stopping this. It's not just about the will of our hearts. It's about the money and the vested interests that are pulling this backwards. So we have to talk openly about that as well. I don't have a step-by-step guide, but neither did John F. Kennedy when he said we're going to put a man on the moon. Nobody put their hand up and said, I'm sorry, you haven't made it absolutely clear how we're going to get there. That was the whole point.
Now we're getting started. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We had to stop. I have to admit that I have a problem with the word donut when talking in the Danish language.
Oh, yeah? First
of all, I don't like donuts very much.
I started with that, Jürgen.
When I met you at the Folkemødet in Bornholm, I gave you a swim ring and tried to persuade you to use the term baderingsøkonomi in Danish. But somehow I felt that didn't work. That didn't work. So now I'll try once again.
You are at least persistent.
We have this beautiful Danish cookie called Vanillekrans. So what about... Yeah. So please go out there and fight for the Vanillekrans economy.
Can we rename this book? Vanillekrans economy.
Thank you so much, Kate, for sharing this energy and message. Thank you, Ida, for coming and trying to be both sympathetic and critical. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Sustainability Design Center and KR Foundation, for making this possible. Go out and take the economy back. Welcome, Kate Rewers, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Congratulations with the Danish publication of your book. It's already going very well, I can tell you.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could explain the power of the image that you have created of the donut. You were in Copenhagen giving a lecture at the university with over 500 people enthusiastically listening. You're going to China to explain this. You've been all over the world. What's the magic of the donuts? What does it mean and why is it so powerful?
I know it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it, to go around talking about donuts for the 21st century economy. But what I've discovered over the last 5 years is the power of pictures. I first drew this diagram and it's basically two concentric circles, one inside the other. So it looks like one of those donuts that has a hole in the middle. That's all it is. But when I first drew this picture, I was absolutely amazed by the response that it got. And I began to ask myself, why is this getting so much traction and interest and excitement? And I started reading about the power of images. And did you know that over half of the nerve fibers in our brains are connected to our eyesight? So our eyes are pattern seekers. They're constantly looking for pattern, for meaning. And the images that go into our heads sit in the visual cortex, which is at the back of our heads. They sit there for decades without us even realizing that they're shaping the way we think and what we see and what we put at the center of our vision and what's peripheral. But when you realize that, then you realize the power of picking up a pencil and drawing a new image. And that's what I aim to do. So imagine a donut with a hole in the middle, and imagine humanity's use of Earth's resources radiating out from the center of this picture or to the edge. So the hole in the middle is a place where people are falling short on the essentials of life. They don't have food, healthcare, education, housing, electricity, political voice, all the social dimensions that we know are a part of leading a good and dignified life. We want nobody left in the hole in the middle of the donut. But at the same time, we can't overshoot the outer ring of the donut because there we put so much pressure on our living planet that we begin to kick it out of balance and we cause climate breakdown, we acidify the oceans, we create a hole in the ozone layer. So when you put those two together, leave nobody in the hole, but don't overshoot the outside. We need to live in this donut-shaped space in which we meet the needs of all people within the means of the planet. And to me, this is the challenge of the 21st century. This is it. This is what we this century must step up to do. We know that at the moment, many millions of people do fall short
we are at risk of creating catastrophic climate change from which we will not be able to return. We know that we are losing other species at an extraordinary rate. We are converting too much of Earth's surface for human use. So the challenge is steep and it can feel overwhelming. But when you actually draw an image that envisions the world we want, this is the place we want to get to, it makes people stop feeling overwhelmed by the challenge and the negativity and start moving towards a positive vision of what they want. That's what the donut's for. And I've been having fascinating conversations with business people, with activist students, with politicians, with urban designers, all asking what would it look like to start from where I work to start moving into this place.
Yeah, and your book is out now in 15 languages, so no doubt about the fascination or the strength of the model and the vision. Still, I've heard politicians say, we don't need these grand models. We need tools to make actual realistic politics. What's your answer to that kind of comment?
I absolutely understand that politicians feel that what they most need is a set of policies that they can go off and advocate for today. That's their job. But the job of others is to envision a new future, which will shape what those policies are. I think we profoundly need a grand new vision of what prosperity is, because the 20th century became ruled by one very narrow vision of what prosperity is. In the 1930s, the brilliant American economist Simon Kuznets was asked by US Congress to come up with a single number to measure the output of the American economy. Because before that, it was measured in bags of grain and tons of steel. And he turned that into one money metric. It's what we now know as national income or GDP. And when he produced it, he said, oh, this would not measure the welfare of a nation. He tried to warn it against using it that way. But the power of a single number created an extreme obsessive focus on GDP and its growth. So we've been enwrapped by a very powerful grand model. And if we're going to free ourselves from that, we need an alternative. I'm amazed by the interest in the donut model of meeting the needs of all people within the means of the planet. That come from people in every walk of life. I love it when people have come up to me after I've spoken at book festival and said, I can't believe I read a book with the word economics in the title and I understood it and I loved it. That to me is the sign of a book that's actually opening and widening the conversation. That's exactly where I want to be.
And I guess there don't need to be any conflict between having and discussing a model and then also looking for practical tools in your everyday life as a politician.
Well, if you don't have a model and a vision of where you want to get to, how on earth are you going to come up with any policies? If you don't know what success looks like, how will you ever know what progress is? So all policies arise out of a model. And to me, I don't try and come to countries like I'm here visiting Denmark. I don't presume to turn up and say you should enact these five policies. That would be inappropriate. But if I can turn up and say, here's a vision of the future of the world, I invite you to look at your own country through this lens and everything that you know about your country and the political reality, ask yourselves what kind of policies would bring Denmark to this place. Because when we look at each country through the lens of the donut, I slightly cheekily but quite seriously say, we are all developing countries now. There is no country in the world that is yet meeting the needs of all of its citizens and doing so within the means of the planet. And Denmark, like the UK, where I'm from, like all high-income countries, look at America or Canada or Australia or European countries, are doing relatively well compared to others in meeting the needs of all of their people. People tend to have some housing, some healthcare, some education, access to electricity, but massively overshooting their impact on planetary boundaries, massive excessive carbon emissions and material footprint and water use and fertilizer use. So we need transformative economic models that actually bring us back within this space. And without a grand vision and aspiration, we'll never find the policies that will get us anything like on the way there.
When you go around the world discussing this with people, Where do you see the sectors leading this transition? Who are the front runners?
You know, I never find it in particular sectors. I find it in individual people. I think change doesn't come from political leaders. I don't think change comes from the innovation of the private sector. I don't think change necessarily always comes from people on the streets either. Change starts in the conviction of an individual. Somebody who says, I'm just determined to make this be done differently. I don't know how I'm going to do that yet, but I'm going to do this differently. So that can happen within business. And there are some people who run incredibly progressive companies. When you go ask them the story of where this came from, guess what? It starts with a moment of conviction and a moment of inspiration and enlightenment, and I can do this differently. But there are also politicians who have a moment of conviction or are driven to have an ambition that stands outside the political normality, what seems pragmatic, and set a new scale of ambition. There are community groups who get together and say, we are going to create a noise that the government cannot resist but listen to. So I think it's, and to me, this is really good news. It's not that leadership is coming from a particular country or from a particular sector. It pops up everywhere. I think we've seen in many countries a failure of national governments to lead on climate change. And when those who are supposed to be leading fail to lead, new leaders pop up, which is why we're seeing so much climate leadership at the level of the city or at the level of individual communities. So it's popping up everywhere. The capacity of people to step in and be leaders from wherever they are is very well distributed, thank goodness, because I think it's a crucial resource.
Yeah. Where the discussion sometimes get difficult is when you touch upon the subject of growth. For example, people close to political decision-making says we have to speak the language of the finance minister to be heard. Mm. Other places you can hear people question growth because obviously the planet cannot take it. So how do we discuss this, which is a very central issue, in a way that is not dividing people but making us wiser?
Well, today's political narrative is very much caught up in the language of growth. It's become embedded ever since Simon Kuznets came up with that number in the 1930s. Our economies have become structurally addicted to growth. They financially, politically and socially expect, demand and depend upon GDP rising forever. So it's written deeply into the structures of our economy. It's just a design, by the way. It doesn't mean it has to always be there, but right now it is. Which is why politicians will speak of progress as if it's always in the shape of growth. And they add an adjective. They'll say it's sustainable growth or inclusive growth, resilient, smart, clean, better, green, greener. Any kind of growth you want, so long as it's growth. That narrative is really deeply embedded. I wanted to help to challenge that because I think we are in a different century. We know so much more than Simon Kuznets or John Maynard Keynes or even Milton Friedman or any of the influential economists of the last century. We know that our lives deeply depend upon the stability of our planetary home. And we know that we have risked radically destabilizing that through the industrial design of our economies. So we now know something that they didn't know, and we can't turn away from knowing that. We have to carry it through. We should never expect last century's economic models to be able to deal with this 21st century challenges because they weren't drawn up for this. These are our challenges. We need new economic models. We need new business models. We need policies of our own to take on for our own times. And for me, the growth question is a crucial one. So I like to stand right back and look to nature. Nature has been thriving on this planet Earth for nearly 4 billion years. So it's a pretty good example to learn from if we also want to stick around. And when you look to nature's growth curve, growth is a wonderful, healthy phase of life. We all love to see our children grow. We want to see our gardens grow. So people think, well, growth is good. Yeah, growth is a wonderful phase of life. But you know what? Our children grow up. My kids are 10 years old. I have twins. Their feet are growing incredibly fast in that big spurt of life. At some point, maybe when they're 18, they'll stop growing. But my children will keep thriving until they are, I hope, 90 or 100. So growth is a phase of life, but in nature, things then grow up and they mature. And that's when they can come to thrive. And why would we expect that our economies would be the one system that would somehow magically, successfully just buck this trend, they would be the one system that would succeed by growing forever. And yes, we think growth is good because we love our kids to grow and our gardens to grow. But you know what? We already know there's another side to the growth story, certainly in English. If I were to say to you, my friend went to the doctor and the doctor told her she had a growth. Well, that's the way we talk about cancer. And if I say that, everybody feels very differently inside about growth. Why? Because we also understand that when something tries to grow forever within a healthy living whole, like a human body, it is a threat to the health of that whole and it needs to be stopped. So let's just take that from the human body to the planetary body. What happens when we have an economic system that is structurally dependent upon growing forever, no matter how rich a country already is? We think what we need is more. What happens when that comes up against our delicately balanced living planet? That, for me, is the existential economic question of the 21st century. And it's incredibly hard for any politician standing up in a parliament talking immediately about today's politics that are going to be reported in tomorrow's newspapers. Incredibly hard for them to talk about that. But that means there's more responsibility on people like me who aren't politicians and aren't employed by major corporations or the European Parliament or the World Bank, but have an independent voice to raise these far deeper questions. And that's why I talk about it.
You have been on this journey with the donut for about 2 years now, meeting all walks of life. Can I ask you as a last question, are you more or less hopeful now than when you started the journey?
So I get huge energy and hope from the very many diverse people who I get to meet through this journey. Sometimes young people come up to me and say, thank you for this book. This puts in a theoretical term and gives an overview to the economy that I'm already part of. I'm part of a cooperative that's using reclaimed wood to make furniture, for example. And this makes it make sense. One young woman once came up to me and said, could you sign this book? My father bought it. He read it. And then he gave it to me and he said, I think I finally understand what it is that you're doing with your life. So I was delighted we can have donut family therapy, that one generation can understand another through a paradigm. So I gain hope from seeing examples of transformation in action. Did you know that over 100 cities worldwide now generate more than 70% of their electricity from sun, wind, waves and geothermal power? That would have seemed like a utopian dream just a decade ago. There are some powerful changes happening. But sometimes people come up to me and say, oh, I love your optimism. And I say, oh, I don't remember saying I was optimistic. In fact, I like to playfully say, don't be optimistic if that makes you relax. You know, oh, humans, we're ingenious, technology, don't worry, we've sorted things out before, we'll sort this one out. No, if optimism makes you go there, don't go there. Don't be optimistic. But also don't be pessimistic if that makes you give up. It's too hard. It's too late. We are too many. There's not enough time. Well, if you take that attitude, then it will be too late and we won't get this done. So don't be an optimist if it makes you relax. Don't be a pessimist if it makes you give up. Be an activist in the very literal sense of the word. Whoever you are, in whatever part of your life you are you a parent? How do you talk to your children? How do you demonstrate the way you live? Are you a student? Are you going to put up your hand and ask that tricky question of your economics professor? Are you a professor? Are you going to change the way you teach? Are you a CEO? Are you going to change your company? Are you a politician? Are you going to dare to step up to the times? Whoever we are in whatever parts of our life, we can change how we eat and travel and bank and invest and divest and protest. We all have networks of influence because these days, if you're not an activist, then you risk being an inactivist. And in great times of change, we all need to be active. So I'm hopeful for us being active in making this change we need.
Thank you very much, Kate Royers, for joining us and good luck with your activism.
Thank you.
Thank you.